This morning, we're talking trees.
Why don't you make like a tree and get out of here?
Biff might want you to leave, but we hope you stay. We've got certified arborist John Eisenhower with Integrity Tree Service here to take your questions at Rosie on the House.
Well, we have a on the break here. I was talking a little bit, Larry, about the benefits of FireWise is not just protecting your property, but what are some of the other benefits of doing some clearance in our forests?
Well, two big benefits, John, is the remaining trees will normally be a lot healthier. They then have more room to grow. They have more water available, that kind of situation. Plus, some insurance companies that insure properties, you know, the homes, sometimes give breaks to people when their property is made firewise.
So if you create a fire break, you might get an insurance break? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, something like that.
Need to check with your insurance company, though, to see if they're willing to offer that.
That's exactly right. Just like with my experience, John, you know, with being a certified arborist for about 16 years now and having a lot of firefighting experience, I can see the forest for the trees. So it works out pretty well.
Well, you know, we've seen that just in some of these outlying areas around Flagstaff where they've done the thinning operations. You finally can see through the forest. And apparently, as I've been reading, doing some research, that there it used to be a lot wider open because the fires used to come through on a pretty routine basis and clean out all of that underbrush, leaving the existing larger mature trees unharmed. But when we, through 100 years ago, some decisions were made to do some fire suppression. And what happened is there was a buildup of those smaller trees, which grew up underneath those. And we were putting out fires as soon as they occurred. Thinking that was going to be the best thing to do. But what happened is that the undergrowth continued to build up to the place where when we had a fire, it became catastrophic.
You're exactly right, John. The pre-settlement times, it was said that you could ride your horse through the forest around Flagstaff at a full gallop very easily. There were 40 to 120 trees per acre. Then with suppression being the thing that was actually thought to be the best with fire suppression, then the forest was allowed to grow up. There were many trees put out in 1919 and 1920, a lot of big seed years, a lot of moisture at that time. With that being the case, a lot of trees came up and it wasn't being burned or thinned naturally, and got to be very choked in the area with too many trees per acre, and soil and the water, amount of water that we received in snow or rain was not able to support the trees.
Right, and then you had those trees of the varying sizes from 2 feet off the ground to 6 feet to 8 feet to 15 feet.
Ladder fuels.
And it's just ladder fuel.
Yeah, exactly.
The fire starts at the bottom and just climbs right to the top of the trees. What a shame to see large tracts of land completely decimated. Whereas 100 years ago, the fire would just move right through the bottom growth and clean out some of that grass. And
yeah, it was called a cool burn. In other words, mm-hmm. The grass was the carrier, and it would put a lot of nutrients back into the ground, especially nitrogen. The trees would use that immediately, and it was a healthy ponderosa pine forest.
I heard something, too. Is there some importance to fire with ponderosas in terms of the germination of the ponderosa seed?
Yeah, it does help the seeds germinate. It helps the cones release the seeds, and then they can germinate a lot easier. So that is a factor in the propagation.
Yeah, walking out through some of the old growth stands around Arizona, sometimes you'll see in the middle of a beautiful forest a couple of charred trunks of some standing trees. So, of course, they've seen fire in years past, and it's interesting when you see the history, even out in some of our stands that are fully mature stands now. So those fires would have been probably 100 years ago or longer.
Oh, easily, and those are called cat faces a lot of times, are those scars. And University of Arizona, they have a lab with
dendrochronology,
exactly, and that's one way of determining how many fires would normally go through in a given period of time.
Dendrochronology is the reading of tree rings.
Study of tree rings, exactly.
Right, and so they can take a slab of wood and start counting back, and they can actually see where the forest fires occurred by how those rings are smaller or larger. And
exactly, and that's how they get to that 2 to 12 years in any particular area. And with that being the case, it really makes for a healthy forest, nutrients back into the ground, cleans out the forest floor, and so on.
You know, just once again, a warning to everyone across the state, you know, in these days when we have high winds. We were just down in southern Arizona last weekend, and they've just had two fires in the last month near the Whetstones and the Santa Ritas, and they've just swept through those grasslands, that high desert grassland around 5,000 feet, and just took out entire tracts of that land. And when the wind gets going, it's just that fire is off and running. And it went from the Santa Ritas to the Whetstones in about an hour and a half, 2 hours, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Really quick. So, yeah, just be careful out there. Do the best you can and observe everything you can do also to just be careful about your cigarette butts and your campfires. And you don't want to be the one that's responsible for setting off a terrible fire that's going to cause a lot of property damage and loss across the state. Well, I wanted to mention a little bit about your services that you provide up here, too. You do a bit of FireWise clearing, don't you?
Yeah, I'm a FireWise assessor for the state of Arizona, and with the experience I've got also, I can check properties, recommend to the clients what needs to be done. I can do that for them, or they can do it themselves. It's every property is different. Topography, the lay of the land, the slope. There's a lot of factors that go into it, and I can check that for them, and again give recommendations.
You work out of Flagstaff, but how far afield will you go?
Well, I go to all of northern Arizona, Grand Canyon, Page, if need be, Holbrook, Sholo, to the west, Ash Fork, Seligman. I go as far south as the Verde Valley and the Mogollon Rim. I will not go to Phoenix. That's not my area. So
yeah, we got you covered there.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, John.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that. The I've got a bird's eye view right now, looking out over this beautiful American ash tree. Tell me a little bit about this.
American elm.
This American elm tree here. Why did this survive? Because American elms were pretty much wiped out in the early part of this, the 20th century. What happened?
Exactly. Yeah, this was planted, I think, early part of the 19th century. Dutch elm disease did not get this far west. There were a couple of groves planted at the Reardon House. They were Reardon brothers that were here in the early 1900s, they planted two groves in front of their Reardon Mansion. It's Reardon Mansion State Park now. And in 1906, 1908, those plus this American elm also on NAU campuses here. And fortunately, Dutch elm disease did not get this far west, so that's why they're here today.
Well, there are other non-susceptible elm species like the Chinese elm that we find commonly in the Phoenix area, but occasionally in Phoenix too, along the Central Corridor and some of the older neighborhoods, we'll come across an American elm. It has a much larger leaf, sometimes 2 to 3 times as large as the Chinese elm, and they're very obvious, very easy to identify, but they're just tremendous trees. And what I like about places like the NAU campus is that you get to see trees that are not just in their kind of teenage years. You're seeing these trees at their zenith of their development and at the height, their full mature height and spread. So if you're in the Flagstaff area and you haven't been to the ASU campus and seen their arboretum, they have a tree walk here. They have three legs of it, and you can find it on their website. And you can walk through, and they have a numbered identification maps, and just use your cell phone and walk through and check out the trees. Most of the ones that are on the tour have a little plaque next to the tree with an identification marker and with some of the specs. And we have arboretums and tree walks on the Arizona community, the Arizona State University campus, on the U of A campus down in Tucson. And, of course, here at NAU, we have a tree walk as well. This campus was awarded the designation as a tree campus USA just recently in the last couple of years. And it's a real honor to have a these legacy trees on this property. Just avail yourself of those opportunities in your location, wherever you are across the state, to take in these beautiful trees that we have, especially here in the high cool country in Flagstaff. This would be a great time of year to take a little visit up here and stroll through here with the kids or your family. Well, we've got some a little bit to talk about rare fruit. I wanted to just touch on this before we leave today. We had a part of our discussion yesterday was not just the fruit trees that are producing like stone fruits that produce a lot of food for us, but there is a organization called the California Rare Fruit Growers Association. If you would like to, if you live in the low desert area and would like to consider planting a mango or a papaya or a loquat or an avocado, there's an organization. We have a chapter of the California Rare Fruit Growers Association in Arizona, and they will show you where to find, how to plant, how to water and prune and harvest, and eventually to process these awesome, more tropical plants. We had a speaker yesterday who kind of introduced us to the whole concept of growing rare fruits in the low desert. And there's this group, if you have any interest in doing so, get a hold of the local Arizona chapter of the Rare Fruit Growers Association, and they'll give you maybe attend one of their meetings, and you'll be brought up to speed on how to get into that process. We've been we just put a loquat in just a few months ago, and we're looking forward to trying to see if we can get one of these rare fruits to grow in our yard as well. If you've got a little microclimate, a little protected area that doesn't have a lot of sun, you've got just the opportunity to put in one of these more rare tree species. You know, it speaks to the whole issue of having microclimates in our yards. Even here in Flagstaff, you've got a little bit of a microclimate at the base of the hills over here where it's a little bit warmer.
Yeah, that's correct, John. Eldon Mountain, with Eldon Lookout on the top, it's a big basalt dome. That's the easternmost of the peaks, I guess you could say. It absorbs the sunlight during the day and gives it off at night. So actually, you know, some areas there right at the base could be two planting zones warmer than the rest of Flagstaff. So it is incredible. I've had clients there that get they get peaches, nectarines, and plums quite often. It is amazing.
We'll be back right after this last segment of Talking Trees. You can join the conversation at 1-888-767-4348.